Kopinen, Sharp, Larson, and Navarre.
Striking tie. Okay.
Salvation Army.
Salvation Army, 1992.
I thought it was Bishop Taddy. But I'll trade you.
Okay, first bill we'll take up is House Bill 431.
31. Ouch. God. Chair's a little high, Mr. Chairman. Smack my knees. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill on us, allowing us the opportunity to work in a subcommittee to come up with some of the changes that were recommended or suggested by the committee. Representative Ivan should be here in a minute, and I can go ahead and explain what we've done in the subcommittee if you wish.
Okay.
Basically, what we've done is when we talked to Lucille Seitz and people involved with the Housing Assistance Loan Fund, the department no longer deals in non-conforming loans. DCRA does not deal with non-conforming loans because it's another component now handled by AHFC and other entities. I'm not a housing expert, so I can't explain the other programs. But what we decided to do is take out the references to non-conforming and rural and make the loan basically a small community loan. And the communities are still defined as they were in the original bill. Population of 5,500 or less not connected by road or rail, or with a population of 1,400 or less connected by road or rail to Anchorage or Fairbanks, but not including the Marine Highway System. But basically what we've done is taken out all the references to non-conforming and rural, and you do have a memo from Representative Ulmer that explains some of the changes made in subcommittee. That's what's incorporated in this draft.
I'll move the CS, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objections? Not objection to the CS report.
Also, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ivan would like to thank Representative Ulmer and staff who worked on this for all their cooperation and help.
I guess for the small towns, you reduced it from 1,500 to 1,400 and basically just eliminate North Pole zone, I see. Is that on the list?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, that's correct. Discussions that we had with the lending institutions and with DCRNA, that other means were available to North Pole. Traditional loans were available to them, whereas in the smaller communities might not have the same opportunities North Pole had. Sandra Wicks from the department is here too, and she can answer any questions that you might have from technical nature that I might not be able to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopinen.
What is the situation of small unincorporated communities that are inside a borough?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kopinen, they'd still be eligible.
Even though they're not on the list? I'm thinking, for instance, Esther,
town of Esther and Fairbanks or Fox.
I'd ask Sandra Wicks to answer that, but it's my understanding that regardless of if they're in their borough or not, they would still be eligible.
Esther's on the list.
Yeah, that's it.
Mr. Chairman, it's interesting to note that between 935 and 1500, there's only one community.
There's a couple other communities that are within that. Aren't there a couple of communities that would be excluded if we raised the number or lowered the number to 1,000?
Yes, Haynes was the one we were most concerned about. Haynes has about 1,246 people.
Oh, I'm looking at the list connected by road or railroad.
That list was prepared for who in the interior could be now served in Haynes and Skagway. Under the old writing of the definition, we're already included, and we don't intend to exclude them.
There's no banking facilities in Haynes and Lynn? I thought they were pretty well covered with alternate commercial financing possibilities. Similar to Houston. Isn't Houston pretty close to Matsu?
Yes.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
With your permission, Mr. Chairman, it's not the lack of banking facilities, because we work with banks. And in fact, Lucille Steets, who was going to testify and explain how this works, is the manager of loan production for National Bank of Alaska. Of course, they're all over the state, and we work with them. They package a lot of loans and bring them to us. We act as a secondary market, just as HFC does. But then HFC turns around and can sell its loans on the national secondary market. But because our loans are so weird, because they may be on a wood seal foundation, or they may have delivered water, or they may have honey buckets or something like that, we can't sell those on the secondary market. But we purchase many of our loans from banks. So it's really the question of availability of other type of financing. And according to Mrs. Steets, in most of these communities, you probably could not get other financing, and that's why the DCRA program is so critical to a lot of these small communities.
You're saying that Haynes can't qualify for Alaska Housing or that type of portfolio?
What she explained to us, and Tom was there at the same time, is that for the secondary market, usually you have to be able to get comparables within a certain number of months. And in small communities, there are not enough sales very often of the same type of house going on that they can meet this comparability requirement. And she said very often people are building their own houses, and there's nothing comparable to what they're building. Maybe, I don't know, Tom, do you want to add anything?
No, you said it right.
Yeah, she enlightened us greatly on the problems. I knew there was a problem, but she gave us a lot of the detail on that.
Representative Kopanen?
Lack of a mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What sort of standards would you have for the housing loans themselves, for the construction? Are you FHA type, or what?
Well, obviously, we can't be as strict as the secondary market, because otherwise you wouldn't be building houses out there, or you wouldn't be selling houses out there. And that's one of the advantages to this program, is that we have people who are very familiar with all of the peculiarities of varying conditions in the small communities around the state. And so we know what, I can't tell you the specific standards myself, but from our experience over the, 10 years that we've been operating this program, we know what kinds of things will work and won't work, and so that's what we approve. And then we have people who go out and inspect during construction, where we're giving construction loans, and then we also have more of a sense of people's ability to pay if they're on seasonal employment and things like that. It's a very tailored program. That's why it's so critical to continue at this
point. So you do make sure that the house will stand and would be
exactly
even, but you also are in a position to lend money on a log house, for example.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which has been one of the points that banks will lend money on log houses or on houses built on permafrost, regardless of the care that they take.
I overheard a question over here. Maybe I could comment on the question of the subsidy. I wrote a letter to, after the previous hearing, to Representative Navarre, which I think all of you have copies of. I looked into this question of whether there is or is not a subsidy
And if you take a glance at that letter, which is dated April 16th, after talking to Lucille Steets at NBA, our statute says that our loan rate will be 1% below HSC's less taxable bond issue. And in fact, they have not issued one for so long that our rate is now between 9 and 9.25, depending on the amount you're borrowing. And in fact, you can get Fannie Mae money for 9% on the day that we talked to her. The day before, you could get it for 8.75.
Right.
This fluctuates. And ours is fixed by this percentage below AHFC's rate. So in fact, there is no subsidy right now.
9% and loans it all to date.
Are there additional questions? Representative Ulmer.
I move that we move the CS for HB 417 from committee with individual recommendations.
At the moment,
I thought we were down here from the banker.
So there are additional questions?
Did
you say there's a banker here?
Yeah.
She was available yesterday, and she's on vacation today. I'm sorry. We had her sitting by the phone for an hour and a half yesterday. And Lucille was going to tell you all the things, or be available to tell you the things that she told us in case you wanted to hear it directly from her.
Yeah, my comment is, my information is that most of the banks in Alaska is awash with money to make loans, conventional loans that they'll even portfolio themselves at even current interest rates. So not a non-conforming loan, but I mean, in some of these areas it's going to qualify. I'm sure that they would be.
Representative Larson.
Just a general question out of my curiosity. Did I understand you to say that if AHF borrows money at 9%, they loan it all to date?
No, they don't borrow it. It's our loan fund. But our loan percentage rate is pegged by statute to AHFC's less taxable bond issue. No, they aren't. No. We aren't that crazy yet.
Mr. Chairman, I said 417. I meant House Bill 431. Sorry.
Which is 417? House Bill 431 from committee with individual recommendations. Chair objection. That objection bill moves to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Do you say so, Phyllis?
Yeah, it's good. Believe me, I would not endorse this. Part of my livelihood.
Next one I'd like to take up is House Bill 264.
Which is what? Which is what? Response fund.
So we've adopted everything we've adopted. We just need to adopt. That's
You haven't had
Okay, we're going to take up House Bill 264. There's an amendment, I think.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to propose an amendment that basically page 4, line 31, after the word payable, insert two tank owners and operators. She's distributing.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. Is this intended just as a clarifying, or are you hoping to change the intent or specify some group of a larger group that might be able to get things? Just to put on the record what the intent of the amendment is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ulmer. Yes, the intent was just to clarify and make specific that the funds would only be used for reimbursement two tank owners and operators, not be available for Department Administrative Personnel Administration cost of the program.
Thank you.
There was some concern last time I heard the bill a month ago, so, and even testimony from someone from DEC said possibility that they could go back retroactively and recoup all the operating costs of the underground tank program of the department from that time. So this would just clarify that.
Okay, thank you.
Is there objections to the amendment? That objection, amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the bill. Motion board.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we pass the new CS for HB 264 finance from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note.
Checked.
There's objection.
It's to the resources committee version.
Secretary, call the roll.
Mrs. Brown. I'm still looking for the fiscal note. Yes.
Representative Copenhagen.
Yes.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative Phillips.
Yes.
Representative Sharp.
Yes.
Representative Ballmer.
Yes.
Representative Boyer.
Yes.
Representative Barnes.
No.
Representative Navarre.
Yes.
9 yay, 1 nay. Oh, excuse me, 8 yay, 1 nay.
Bill moves from committee with individual recommendations. House Bill 417 will not be taken up today. Last one we have on the calendar is HDR 80.
Chairman, before we get started on this, can I just register my protest? I oppose this and go.
What? I don't have a packet on HDR 80.
To unicameral legislature.
Yeah, they don't vote. That's one of the seats we're eliminating on the unicameral. Is yours?
That bill didn't move out.
Right? How did this bill, the unicameral? One of the seats is yours being eliminated.
Okay. Thank you.
You know,
who's your professor?
One thing he doesn't have is the vote back in 76. Yep, sure did. I was going to pull it out there.
Yeah, you showed me the vote.
Yeah. HDR 80 is a unicameral legislature bill. I think it would provide for a more accountable and responsible form of government. Just imagine if your local assemblies were bicameral rather than unicameral. The original justification and reasoning behind the bicameral system was goes back to English days, and then when we came across the ocean, had arguments between big states and small states. The compromise was that there would be a Senate which would be represent geographic areas, individual states. Everybody would get two regardless of size or population, and the population was accommodated by having another House, House representatives that would be apportioned by population. The Supreme Court ruled in a couple of cases in 1962 and 64 that states could not apportion by geographic area as they'd done at the U.S. level, that you had to do it by population. As a result, I think that what you have is two bodies representing exactly the same types of or exactly the same number of population, and what it does is it sets up a series of on both sides, duplication on both sides, which is unnecessary given that it's both bodies are representing the same population. There are some arguments that suggest that the checks and balances in the legislature require the two bodies. I think that is not in fact the case. In fact, I think it's allows a lot of things to happen that maybe ought not to happen, either through leveraging bills through one body or the other, or as we've seen from time to time, bills that pass one body simply because they think the other body's going to fix them. Also, the end of session fiascos that we see are a direct result of having two bodies which are not in sync through most of the end of the session. The conference committees at the end of the year are open to lots of abuses, and so I just think that it's time to consider putting on the ballot an initiative that would allow for a unicameral system. It did pass in an advisory vote in 1976, I think.
Right.
Yeah, 76. And my argument, Representative Barnes.
Mr. Chairman, you have spoken already as to the question of the checks and balances. I do not believe that the unicameral legislature allows for the checks and balances. There is only one state in the nation, Nebraska, which has such a system, and that in itself should tell you that if it was such a great thing, then perhaps more states would have seen fit to go to a unicameral system. Wouldn't matter if we took testimony all day. I would still believe this does away with one of the checks and balances in the system, so therefore I oppose it.
Thank you, Representative Barnes. The reason that Nebraska was the only state that has gone to a unicameral system, they went clear back in the 30s, I believe. But other states, on the old system, other states could be apportioned by geographic area, and Alaska was, in fact, apportioned on geographic area, and the Senate was by geographic area, the House was by representation. When the Supreme Court ruled that you can't do that anymore, then of course what you had in all of the states was a status quo, and whenever you try to change the status quo, regardless of justification many times, you run into opposition, and that's what has happened in all of the states, and including Alaska. It's the checks and balances are not the impact. The checks and balances between the internal bodies of the House and Senate would be changed, because then the checks and balances would manifest themselves in the committee process and things like that in one body, rather than having two bodies that are essentially duplicating each other. And the checks and balances between the branches of government, the executive and the legislative and the judicial, would not be impacted by going to a unicameral system.
I could just respond, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. Let me point out that I believe that you need checks and balances between the bodies. This moves one of the checks and balances between the bodies that manifest itself, but checks and balances also on the administration.
Representative Copeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the privilege of being a member of the All Alaska League for State Constitution, which was organized by former Territorial Commissioner of School Jim Ryan in Fairbanks, and participating in the discussions that led to the original Constitutional Convention, and of working for the university at that time and being assigned to provide the lighting and electrical and recording systems for the Constitutional Convention, so I observed the whole thing. I testified in favor of the unicameral legislature when the question came up, introduced by John McNeese, the delegate from Nome. The question was argued very closely, and in fact, there was very great support for a unicameral system at the Constitutional Convention. And it probably would have carried, except that some of the members who tended to favor it were afraid that going to something so held only by Nebraska would make Congress uncertain about Alaska being too experimental. So they settled for a much more traditional system. I remember that argument fairly vividly. The argument was actually very tight because it was the intention of the founders to set up a very strong administrative system, one elected official, the governor. And in the subsequent years, the actions of the court system in response to various attorneys general have strengthened that role via the legislature, even though the governor, succeeding governors after Greening and Egan, have not been able to quite comprehend the size of the bureaucracy they govern. Nevertheless, they have gained from the legislature the they have restricted the legislature in its existing review of regulations, which was the traditional means in territorial days and also under the early governors in statehood days. They have also extended their right of appointment to the point that there are 1,305 political appointees in the current administration. And the only ones who are subject to review are those that are named in the Constitution. So, obviously, the growth of the bureaucracy and the, regardless of who is governor, Democrat or Republican, has continued apace. The legislature has not been able to properly check the system and to balance the increased power on the governor, the bureaucracy, and the court system. I think that, as we discussed at the time, having two houses meeting at opposite ends of the hall was like running a race with your shoelaces tied together from both feet, and then that increasing the power of the governor. And the result is, of course, that the internal legislative body is so checked that it cannot balance the governor, and I do think that I applaud a friend of ours bringing the question of unicameralism back up again.
I do support this, Mr. Chairman. One question I have is, what were these people be called?
Senators. They call them senators.
Members of the legislature.
Doesn't say that anywhere. It just deletes all the language from senators.
Nebraska is called senators.
Senators in Nebraska.
Yeah. You can call them legislative members.
But all the way through here, it's just calling them legislature and legislators, and I was just wondering how would that be for a title?
Legislature.
How about if we change it to senator?
How about
MLA?
Yeah. So where it says...
Might make the Senate happier.
We're just giving them a promotion here. I have one question.
I'm just trying to... See what I'm saying? That
yeah,
there's no title thing. My other question, Mr. I think it would be better to either call them senators or reps or something, but in the transition to a single body, you'd have this occurring transition period during the 18th legislature, and then I'm looking at the fiscal note and just thinking about the practicality of conversion. Shouldn't there be at least a small cost shown in the fiscal note for Randy shaking his head? I mean, in what physical location would we be equipped at this time without extensive renovations to sit as one body? I just think you'd have to make some kind of renovations or adjustments to the chambers to accommodate more people in there. Maybe it's not a big deal, but seems like there would be some cause associated with the conversion.
There might be a good reason to pass this after all. We could build a new capital and we'll.
I have a slightly different idea.
Yeah.
I know you would, Frank.
Willett and Palmer and Wasilla.
Yeah. Okay, is there objection to changing the reference so that it reflects the body being called senators?
Oh, slightly.
Of all things, anyway.
Slightly.
What do you want to call it?
Oh, something meaningful like public servants or servant Brown. Servant Brown.
Citizen.
Citizen King. Right, or Connor.
I like that. Citizen.
Or,
resident.
Okay, we'll have a draft to change it to reflect that we'll call him Senator. Unless there's objection. Representative Copeland.
I don't have a particular desire to impede action, but one of the questions about the veto would be, in a few states and in most democratic countries and in the Canadian provinces, the succeeding legislature can act on a veto within the first days. In fact, that becomes very often the issue on which the actions of the preceding government are, of course, one of the issues of in the election. And we might consider at some future time the action upon veto as a separate question. I'm not suggesting we offer this as a change now, but it would seem reasonable that should, in the final session of the legislature, bicameral or unicameral or quadricameral, as some used to be, that the issue of the vetoes would be one of the issues around which the campaign would be fought. And if the next legislature, when there comes one election on the issue of the veto, they should be allowed to vote on it immediately instead of going through the process of waiting essentially for the end of the fiscal year before they can act on it, because sometimes those are issues that require immediate action. But I don't wish to offer an amendment to this to Section 9 at this point.
Representative Phillips.
Question. Page 6, sections 22 and section 23, you have 50. And why 50? And why not 61? Okay, the reason I'm bringing it up is that, you know, let's deal with the practical side. You're going to be cutting out 10, and, you know, people are going to be fearful of losing their seats under this thing. So my suggestion would be 61. The reason for 61 is a tiebreaker, because I can foresee having a 25-25 vote or a 30-30 vote. And what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to have an odd number to break it.
I actually could...
My suggestion would be 61.
The number that we put in here was to reflect that going to from two bodies to one body and going with 50 members would actually mean that everybody would be representing fewer people in single districts.
Oh.
Because you'd be dividing this population by 50 instead of by 40 and 20.
Is it 6 to 13,000?
There would be no difference between 40 or 20.
Yeah. Okay. So it'd be closer to 1 to 10,000 then. Rather than 13 if you went to 50 members instead of 40 members. The question as to whether you have 50 or 51, or if you want to go to a higher number, I don't really have any problem with a different number. I was just thinking that fairly unwieldy under any circumstances. So, but if we went to 55?
Speed limit?
55 was the number of delegates to the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, that's true.
Both the State Constitutional Convention, the original American Constitutional Convention called Annapolis, which is why we picked the number 55 when we made the recommendation to the legislature for the territorial legislature for the convention. The 55 would have precedence in both American and Alaskan history.
So that'd be one legislator per 10,500 people.
It'd also give us an odd number without to worry about.
Bill 55.
Okay, the motion is to change the number from 50 to 55. Their objection. Without objection, that'd be on page 6, two places on page 6 and on page 1 on line 7. The other change will be to reflect the following senator.
On line 4 through 6 on page 8 would have to be changed from 26 elected one time and 27, 28.
I remember at the time of the Supreme Court decision, Senator Stevens was one of the people who said that there was to consider a unicameral legislature, even because there would be no further justification for a separate Senate. He didn't pursue the question, but he was quoted publicly. I remember him making that statement.
There is only one other thing that on the veto it requires three quarters and two thirds. Three quarters would actually be 41.25.
And you need 42.
So you need 42. There's no problem with that.
If somebody wants to split their vote, percentage-wise.
Move one quarter.
For this and three quarters over here.
Three quarters to sustain. Further discussion. Representative Copeland.
I move that HJR committee substitute for HJR 80 finance committee.
Object.
With individual recommendations.
Still object.
Secretary Caldwell.
President Copeland.
Yes.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative Phillips.
Yes.
Representative Sharp.
Yeah.
Representative Allman.
Yes.
Representative Boyd. Representative Byrne.
No.
Representative.
Honestly.
McMahon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative Navarro.
I have a weedy.
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
All right. Does that go with a pay raise in there?
With the
7 years.
Yeah,
does
that mean less of us, more pay? We take the other 5 new members' pay.
$100,000. You went to
no wreck and think about it.
No, I don't have to think about it.
This is real.
It's bullshit.
Oh, really?
So I can put no rec by no rec.
Really good answer, but I'm not sure there is a really good answer.
Finance Committee meeting will come to order. Members present, Representative Copeland, Larson, Boyer, Homer, and Navarre. First bill to take up is Senate Bill.
Thank you.
That's
great.
329, Senator Porcheau.
Senator Porcheau. Unless you wanted to go to the bottom of the list.
Usually the mics in House Finance are excellent, as opposed to Senate Finance. Yours wasn't on for some reason.
You're up.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to give my spiel that I gave last time again. There were a couple of questions. I know Representative Ulmer had some questions on liability. We had some testimony, and there's some backup in your packets along those lines. I think that we've, in the House Finance CS, tried to clarify as much as is possible this question of liability. Frankly, there are, ultimately unknowns. Other states have faced these things. They
generally end up in lawsuits, and there's no way of predicting whether boards or commissions or pension managers have acted prudently or not until usually they're adjudicated, and I think that's a similar case. We do track, I think, very well according to how the state currently handles personal liability for board members. We're certainly, this bill is in deference to our constitutional protections against pension benefits, which cannot be taken away and will always be honored by the state. So I think we've gone as far as we can in clarifying that point. There was another point left off, Mr. Chairman, that you had expressed some interest in or some concerns relative to independent legal counsel. I just leave that to the committee. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. I think it's clearly just a question for your own judgment.
Are there further questions for Senator Fitzgerald? I guess with respect to the independent legal counsel question, I don't have any real strong feelings about it. Just seems like if we're going to have them independent, they ought to be independent. But I can also understand the Attorney General's concern. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think that the way when we last had this, I had moved the adoption of the working draft as bill before us, and then I'd also, there was the pending motion that I'd made was to adopt the suggested language of the Attorney General, depending on, and that was the pending motion, and that was based on the language from the April 9 letter from James Baldwin. It's 2 page 3, line 30.
Yeah.
After to insert the following material subject to the approval of the Attorney General.
Okay.
There's objection. Is there further discussion? Secretary, call the roll.
Representative Kopanen?
Yes.
Representative Larson?
No.
Representative Vollmer?
Yes.
Representative Boyer?
Yes.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative Jackal?
Yes.
Representative Navarre?
No.
4 yay, 3 nay.
Representative Boyer.
Mr. Chairman, with that, I would move that we pass out the House CS for Senate Bill Number 329, Finance, with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes.
Fair objection. Without objection, the bill moves to the committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Next bill we'll take up is House Bill.
Get something out of here.
What was it? Is it pension fund?
Yes.
I should have yeah. I said fiscal notes, so.
Right, we said notes.
There's a new fiscal note here.
Mark the way.
Looks like the old one. Okay, I'll amend the motion that we just had to adopt the fiscal note dated 4/23/92 rather than one dated 1/27/92. Anyway, the amount should be 3013.2 rather than 2736.1. Is there objection? Without objection, the fiscal note that moves.
Fiscal note one.
Yeah, that is. There are two fiscal notes. This one does. So there are two fiscal notes. One total 176.9. The other is 3013.2. Pardon?
The letters
in stand. Oh, I didn't see the letters in stand. There is a Senate State Affairs letter of intent.
Yep. passes.
I wish you had someone to explain the purpose of the letter of intent.
Can we have city reports open?
Mr. Chairman?
This is the letter of intent that just said they should try to do business with companies in Alaska.
Actually, it's very similar to one we adopted last year on the bill that the government voted.
I'll move the letter of intent also. Is there objections? Without objection, the letter of intent is adopted. Take up House Bill 556, okay. Okay. At this time.
That one out.
Senator Wyden.
Yep.
329, got it. One bill is enough. You're back again?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the Special Committee on Military and Veteran Affairs, I want to thank you for your scheduling this bill at your earliest convenience. And House Bill 556 is an effort to have school districts prepared in the event of an earthquake disaster. And currently, school districts are required to have drills to evacuate school buildings. And this decided in the statute 1403-140. However, in the event of an earthquake, simply leaving the building may not be the best prescribed method for the safety of school children. The bill requires the Division of Emergency Services to work with local school boards in order to have plans and procedures in place for emergency earthquake procedures. The extent of planning and adoption of procedures will be developed by the local school boards. In areas where the risk of earthquake is not as high as other portions of our state, the division and local school board would be able to adopt less stringent plans than areas where there's a high earthquake probability. And funding for plan implementation would be provided by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And the agency would provide for material and other related expenses needed for planning and procedure implementation. And we have with us, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Irv Martin from the Division of Emergency Services available for to answer technical questions on the implementation of this legislation.
Where's Irv?
Right there.
Oh, there.
Okay. There a question?
My neighbor, Representative Ivan. Representative Larson.
Just a comment. Representative Ivan made me think back in 1964. The first earthquake, of course, was about 5:34, 5:35 in the evening on Friday, so school wasn't in session. But the following Friday, there was an aftershock that was about 6-7 on a Richter scale. And I tell you, when we were within 5 seconds of that aftershock, there wasn't a kid left in the school building.
It was more like 8, Ron.
Was it?
Yeah, yeah, I remember that one.
But, yeah, they were on their way out the door, I remember that.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Phillips? I just have one question here. Deals with private or religious schools. Have you gotten any feedback on that, any resistance from people, or they've been pretty cooperative, or you think it's a good idea for their schools as well?
I'll have to defer that question to Mr. Tom Wright, who my staff person may have had contact with religious groups. I certainly have not.
Madam Chair, Representative Phillips, for the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff for the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. We have not had any negative feedback from the religious or school districts under 50. In fact, some of the schools that had an enrollment of less than 50 wanted to be included. or wondered why they weren't included. And we said, you know, we'd be willing to have them take part if they contact the division. We're just not mandating that they have plans and procedures implemented.
What, okay, are the schools, the private schools, aware of this, Bill? Have they been sent a copy or notified?
Madam Chair, Representative Phillips, I haven't sent a copy out. No, not from the committee.
I was thinking that's a problem.
I have several questions. Are you completed? Tom, would you please stay? One, is there a federal mandate requiring these plants?
Madam Chair, I think I'd rather defer to Irv Martin from the Division of Emergency Services to answer some of these questions. He has more expertise than I do.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Ivan?
Irv's my neighbor.
Oh, yeah.
Madam Chair, for the record, I identify myself as Irv Martin, Director for the Division of Emergency Services, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Do you want me to go ahead and answer the question?
Well, did you wish to testify?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I can respond
you
to your question. It is not mandated by the federal government at this time. When we started participating in the earthquake program, there were only 10 states. There are 31 states who qualify for it, but with the reduction in revenues, some of the states can't come up with state money to meet the federal money that's being provided. There's a new initiative underway by the federal government to increase a national earthquake education program. And we are one of three states who set in on that national policy. That's a trend, the direction that I see as a direct result of Loma Prieta and the New Madrid fault. But at this time, it is not mandated.
Then, if you're answering questions, I've got several others. Now, if it's not mandated, will there be federal monies available to districts that pursue the earthquake safety courses?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Because we were one of the first states who have actively pursued the earthquake program, we attempt on leveraging additional earthquake education monies from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They provide the curriculum course from Sesame Street and Big Bird and all the rest of it. We will provide the technical assistance for modifying model plans. It's kind of like a plug-and-shove cookbook tailored to the individual school based upon the degree of threat.
Mm-hmm. One last question that I had. There are regions within the state of Alaska which don't anticipate any earthquakes. Now, what are the plans for those? Are the plans for curriculum, are they going to be extensive? Are they going to be allowing a lot of time to teach earthquake safety courses where you will not be expected to have any earthquakes?
Madam Chair, you are correct. The state of Alaska is in five basic zones, five being the highest threat, one being the lowest. The North Slope would be in a one zone, South Central Alaska and Southeast Alaska, and the Aleutians would be in a five zone. The major hubs of Alaska, however, Fairbanks, Anchorage and Juneau, where everybody travels through, should be provided a basic awareness, but the one zone schools would have a minimal acquaintance with the earthquake threat, and the five zone school threat would have a more intensified plan and preparedness and training curriculum.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we pass out the CS for House Bill 556S with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes.
Are there objections? Without objection, the bill moves to committee with individual recommendations. Next bill will take up the Senate Bill 301. Senator Ewing.
And this one.
This one. Rick, Senator Ewing.
Rick, you're on.
You're not speaking.
It's showtime. whole thing at home.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have to thank you for a minute. I've had like six things going on at once.
Come on.
We, despite what people think, we do work in the Senate. At least in the last 3 weeks. Senate Bill 301, the act relating to the municipal fiscal notes for bills and resolutions, and one that's gone through the process, gone through the Senate.
Right.
And it's been introduced really to assist the local governments at all levels in reducing the number and amount of mandates placed on them by at least publishing the cost of the proposed bills and resolutions in a fiscal note form. Sandra Wicks is here from Community and Regional Affairs, and certainly we've worked on a number of issues, and this one with Community and Regional Affairs. The bill requires that that there must be a municipal fiscal note that accompanies the bill as it goes through the process. As you know, so many programs are in past legislative history, a number of programs affect the costs to the cities and local governments in an adverse way. And what this bill would do would allow the Community and Regional Affairs group of people, the department, to prepare a fiscal note for the last committee referral. Alaska is not alone in considering municipality fiscal notes in all 28 states. In 28 states, as a matter of fact, require fiscal notes disclosing the cost to local entities resulting from the passage of proposed legislation. This bill allows the legislators to be able to see what the exact costs are going to be and what they'll be passed on to local entities. There's a $37,000 .3 fiscal note that was put on in the Senate Finance Committee, and that is also here and enclosed. Basically, they felt they could do this with a six-month part-time person. Personal services, $28,000.9. Originally, I believe the Community and Regional Affairs came up with an $80,000 fiscal note. Senator Adams requested a lesser amount, and it was reduced to the level at 37.3, putting on a six-month permanent part-time person just for the session. And I'd be glad to answer any questions on the bill.
Senator Larson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Union, I noticed that the backup information on the bill says that the fiscal note should be placed by the committee of last referral. Was there any discussion in regards to that? Because the other fiscal notes are placed by the committee of first referral here.
Yeah, we have teleconference. The reason that came out from Community Regional Affairs and the department's recommendation, because they felt that they could better scramble and get that information when it came out of the last committee referral. It gave them more time to be able to put the information together, and they felt kind of squeezed on it. I believe it was the recommendation of Community Regional Affairs, but I'll have to rethink. Wasn't that your suggestion? Sandra
Wicks. There's been a whole evolution.
She'll be here to testify on that part of it, but that was the idea. And originally, we did have, I believe, the first committee referral camp, and it was changed. And it gives it's a little bit easier. Most cases, the last committee referral is the finance committee when it has financial impacts anyway. It's a good one. It gives them time to be able to put it together.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up then. Does that mean the committee of last referral in each body?
Yeah, I believe it does mean it be each body, not just in one body.
Right.
And I would assume that's a positive as well as a negative fiscal note.
Well, of course it could be. And that would be, the department would be preparing it. They could prepare a positive as well as a negative.
The concern I have, and I'll ask the department, is that if we have to take the time and have the department prepare a fiscal note in regards to the state at the committee of first referral, what is the advantage other than giving them a little bit more time to do their work at the committee of last referral? And maybe they gain an advantage, but the various committees within the legislature are at a disadvantage of having incomplete information. Thank you.
Do you have any problems if we added in here that they must be accurate and not try to influence legislation? By a big fiscal note or municipal assistance will be withheld from that community?
In other words, you want to put a municipal a penalty on it.
Or San Wilmer.
Could we do this for the federal government as well?
I think so.
So that when they pass things down to the states, we could maybe get Congress to think about that.
After our deficit, we may not have a federal government.
Really. My only question about it is really the fiscal note. I really wonder if there is enough legislation every session to justify this position. I don't know. Perhaps you've done an analysis to look at the number of bills that are currently in the hopper, for example, that would have required such a fiscal note. It just seems to be a bit much, but maybe not.
Well, as we speak, here we are. We have in the 16th legislature, there was 262 that affected municipalities in some way. 32 of them were duplicates, leaving about 230. And in the 17th legislature, about 270. And some of them are duplicates, so there wouldn't be quite as much work there involved in it. This is, and I have a copy of a memo on the amount of legislation that's gone through that's had some kind of impact on cities and municipalities. And this memo is dated March 1st from Scott Burgess, and we can provide you with a copy of it.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. I just note that it requires them not only to comment or to prepare a statement on legislation that affects municipalities, but on all legislation to determine whether it does or doesn't, and that's certainly a major job. And I was just wondering if you considered any approach such as having the Municipal League or some other allowing municipalities to, you know, a process where we can put the burden on somebody other than a full-time state employee. Because I think it is true that when legislation is being considered, particularly when it starts moving, that affects local governments, we usually hear about it in some way. And I was just wondering if that might be a way to achieve the, while maybe not as thoroughly quantified, at least to flag for people's attention that this measure has a local government impact. Because I think that's really what we're trying to achieve, so because it's not going to affect anything other than our information before action is taken.
Well, you've got a really good point. In other words, let's say you have the Municipal League do it or something like that. That's a possibility. We discussed this in one of the earlier committees referral on the Senate side. I think it was House, one of the committees. And basically, Committee of Regional Affairs felt, and I won't speak for them very long, but they felt like they were in constant touch with these real, real small communities, and that they could be impacted, that they had a grapevine of information that went out to those that group of people. And it wasn't so much for the large communities like Anchorage, or in the case of Representative Ulmer, Juneau, where the seat of government is right here in Juneau, but they're out there, and they're real interested in finding out what's going on as well, and it would be sort of a way of providing that information to some of those smaller communities. So we were trying to be equal and impartial for all communities and ask whether they were large or really small. And Community Regional Affairs can go through that because we've really worked with them the whole way through. And we really appreciate the Representative Navarro's quick and prompt attention to this bill.
Yeah, I was just thinking from the context of reading the back of it, it sounds like that the fiscal note that now accompanies the bill is not adequate to do what the department thinks is needed, and I'm just wondering, given really what we're looking here is sensitivity to, if we wouldn't be just as well off with some kind of pass-through system that allowed any municipality or local government or nonprofit representing municipalities like the Municipal League to funnel them to some point and just have them sent over and attached.
Well, that's not a bad idea. In fact, if you didn't want to have, if you didn't want to put a part-time person on, you could just give them a fiscal note of contracting at $30,000 or $35,000. They could just contract it out. Everything is always thought about in the sense of an employee here, a position here, an 18B or 14C, or you know, and there's other kinds of methods that can be used.
Because when you consider, Mr. Chairman, the impact that we make for the agencies by introducing legislation, discussing it, having hearings, moving along, I mean, and none of that is really budgeted. And I know agencies spend a lot of time responding to the requests from the legislature for various things, and I think they could almost, if you were just going to set up a pass-through system so that it would be formally attached and considered and move along, that you could do that within the context of what we're already doing without having a new employee.
Representative Phillips.
I had the same concerns as Representative Brown has just pointed out, but I kind of like this thing about the Municipal League taking it over. And they have, do they have a position on this, or just something new we just came up in the last 2 minutes?
They support.
No, what I'm saying is, will they do the actual fiscal notes for...
I'm sure they'll do anything if they get paid for it.
Right.
I won't speak for them.
You're here. Oh, you're here. Oh, okay. Why don't you answer my question?
You know, a lot of these questions, you know, some of my experts here could probably answer that better than I can. I'll, any other questions for me? I'd like to listen to this.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Come on up. I guess I have a question though, Rick, and that is that it's not like they're not paying attention anyway.
I know.
And I mean, we hear what the impacts are, and the people from the different communities certainly pay attention to those. So I guess I'm just wondering whether or not this is in fact needed, or whether it's just another piece of paper that we'll have to shuffle around our desks.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I hope it does have some impact on it. And, you know, it does have a sunset clause on it. I mean, so if it doesn't work, you know, it sunsets. That seems to be the sort of the hot thing these days, is put sunset clauses on my bill. But anyway, if it doesn't work for 3 or 4 years, it's repealed. So give it a try.
$100 million.
Once again, I'm Sandra Wicks, Department of Community and Regional Affairs. I had prepared multiple copies of the letter that was written to Pat Rochelle, but I understand it's in your packet that sort of explains, I think, pretty succinctly the department's position on this. We are certainly in favor of the concept. We think that the legislature ought to be informed of the fiscal impact of mandates that are being enacted on the local governments. The problem that we have had, and we've been working back and forth with the sponsors of both the House and Senate versions of this, is that if we're going to make this law, that this not be a sham exercise, and that we be funded sufficiently to do a real job. And our concern now is not so much with the wording of the bill as with the funding of it. When this was initiated, we put in a fiscal note for one full-time person and two seasonal people. And this, in Senate CRA, a letter of intent was attached, and I think that was $137,000. A letter of intent was attached saying, we think that Legislative Affairs could do this more cheaply. And at Senate Finance, Legislative Affairs said, no, we can't, and don't give it to us. And then at Senator Adams' request, we prepared under protest, you'll know if you look at that $37,000 fiscal note, that we said this is not the one that we recommend, but we wanted the figures to be accurate so we could get like a whole person with the right numbers there. So we did prepare it for them. But we proposed an alternate, which is the $80,000 fiscal note that you see attached there, which would provide for a range 18 for 8 months so that we could start the person before AML and have them meet the people they're going to have to be working with and start setting up their network so they can quickly poll people and know who they're talking to, because you know that every year the local officials change. And because these aren't going to be permanent employees, we don't know that a person's going to work for 8 months, take 4 months off, and want to come back to that job later. We may have a new person every year, and so we need to have some system for getting them plugged into the whole process. And then we have proposed a range 16 to assist that person, but that person would only be there for the 6 months of the session. What we anticipate is that because the bill says significantly increases a bill or resolution except an appropriation bill significantly increases cost to a municipality, well, we're going to have to evaluate them all to figure out whether we think there's going to be a significant increase, to figure out which ones we're then going to really seriously track. And it says that if it does not significantly increase cost to the municipality, a statement to that effect shall be attached. So we've got to do work there. And then, as written, this is to clarify some, a question that came up later. It says, the last committee to which the bill is referred on the day is introduced in the House of Origin shall request a municipal fiscal note. As written, this does not necessarily say that, that both houses will get a fiscal note. I think it makes sense that they should, but that's more work if you have to do it twice, particularly if there have been changes. And the problem for us, if we have a lot of bills going through with the 5 days and the 2 days, is that if we've only got one person working during the session, we can't possibly comply with two-day turnarounds on lots of bills. And the information that's provided by AML says that conceivably you could have a lot of bills going through. They may not all make it, but you could have a lot of bills being churned through that we would have to respond to. Our concern is really we don't want to be put in the position of not being able to do an adequate job of something that we're asked to do, although we do support the concept. So we would ask you to pass this out, but to put the $80,000 fiscal note on instead of the $37,000 one.
How about if we just take out the section that says if it doesn't significantly increase costs, a statement of that effect shall be attached. I mean, why should you have a statement if it's not significant, because the cost of preparing the statement and...
Right. That's that. I mean, everything that you do to reduce this is going to allow us to use whatever resources you give us to focus on the work that really needs to be done. And, you know, whatever we are given to do, we will do with that person that is funded or those people who are funded. But we, you know yourselves, you've taken a large number of positions out of our department. We can't put other people on this task. My position is gone. I don't know who's going to do the work that I do, let alone trying to cover because there's extra work because of this bill. But we do want to see this enacted in some form so that we can have these municipal fiscal notes. Are there other questions?
How about if we just said a municipality may offer a fiscal note to a bill?
Well, I think they can already, can't they? That doesn't, I think, get you where you want to go. The concern that we have, of course, is, you know, I was listening to the earlier discussion, and certainly communities that are aware will contact you or can contact you, but we have lots of communities out there. One of the reasons we think that this is going to be a fairly cumbersome task to do a good job of is that we have communities ranging from 25 people in size to 250,000, and we're going to have some way of kind of grouping these and having some sense of what are the fiscal impacts on categories and having a network of communication with representatives of these different categories. It's something worth doing, but I don't think that one person coming on just before the session who may have no experience with local governments, with rural Alaska, you know, with any of these things, can do alone. And that's why we're hoping to at least have this 8-month person with the pairing up of a 6-month person during the session.
Representative Barnes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, listening to the testimony, I guess I'm a bit surprised at seeing this bill before us, because we always hear from the Municipal League and the different municipalities how much a bill is going to cost. So I recall we just had this budget before us and did considerable cutting, and here we are now trying to add back positions that I don't think we have the money to fund.
Representative Barnes. Representative Brown.
I have some reservations about increasing the budget and taking this on, but one thought that I had was that if we left the first sentence in the bill and then strike the next sentence, if the measure does not increase costs, and then say the Finance Committee in the House of Origin shall prepare the municipal fiscal note based on public testimony or communication with the committee. And then you would have a formalized way of bringing to the attention of the body before the vote is taken, as well as the other body, what the impacts are estimated to be as best the Finance Committee can determine from the information available. And we know that a lot of fiscal notes we see go through here have indeterminate written, you know, or estimate unknown. The departments just don't know because they don't have the time or the information available to them to prepare a really precise estimate. So I do support the concept of us taking a more conscious account of what we're doing and how it affects municipalities, but there should be, I think, some way that we could provide that without getting into the kind of in-depth analysis and surveying everybody and everything that's anticipated in this bill as it's drafted right now. So I'd favor going with something like that. Maybe the Finance Committee isn't the right one, but it would be a logical thing for our committee to consider, does this legislation have municipal impact? What is it? What's our best guess at it? And attach some statement on behalf of the committee as the thing moves forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson and then Barnes.
I guess just a real general question. We're going to be working on a capital budget. And within the municipality of Anchorage, there's 103 different projects that in some way or another is going to have a operating cost or maintenance cost or some cost for the next 5 years. Does that mean you're going to have to go by project for all 103 projects and try to figure out what they're going to cost for the next 5 years in order to provide that information so that we can have a fiscal impact on local municipalities within the capital budget?
I think that's covered under the exclusion of appropriations bills, isn't it?
Line 4.
Representative
Barnes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I like the way the direction that Representative Brown is moving, so maybe we could have a subcommittee of Representative Brown and myself to work on this.
You want on it too?
No, I was just going to respond to the reasoning of changing the bill. And we have bills that have zero fiscal note, and they don't go to Finance Committee, but they go to the floor for a vote. And because there's no fiscal impact to the state, but there may be fiscal impact to the municipalities, so therefore we have bills that may not go to Finance, and so would Finance have to do a fiscal note for them? And how do we know?
Maybe we should just have this require the sponsor to tell us what the impacts are on municipalities. Okay, we'll have Representative Brown, Representative Barnes, and
Representative Phillips. Well, wait a minute, I hear from the Missile League here.
Okay.
Crystal?
Who else wants to be on the subcommittee? Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Crystal Smith, appearing on behalf of the Municipal League. We do support this bill. The issue of municipal fiscal notes, as it is tied in particularly with the whole issue of state mandates, has been an issue that's been on the Municipal League's in the policy statement and certainly near the top of our list for a long time. As has been mentioned here already, there are obviously a whole variety of bills that affect municipalities and cause impacts for those mostly negative fiscal impacts. And Senator Ewing referred to the survey I did this research. It was a very quick and dirty, but just going down and looking at the list of bills that we track, which is 300 to 400 session we track that we see as affecting municipalities. And there were about 70 of them, 74 this year, that have a fiscal impact. And some of them are ones that I didn't think of until I started really analyzing. And it's real obvious when you say you shall, do something with your solid waste, or you shall exempt your senior citizens from property tax. Those things are very obvious. But there are lots of other things. Several of them that affect school districts, several of them that are things like the various things that you do, the adjustments you make to the retirement system, those all affect municipalities. And so we support the concept, certainly, of preparing these. As Senator Ewing also said, there's a lot of, there's a national interest in this, and National League of Cities has recently done some work on it, and there are lots of states that are requiring these. There are, of course, some states that require that do not, and this is another issue that I know is an issue of Anchorage's, is the whole issue of mandates that a mandate, an unfunded mandate, would not be allowed. This is one step toward providing additional information so that those of you who are the policymakers can take that into account as you do it. I, we too would like Representative Ulmer's suggestion that the federal government do this both on the states and on the municipalities, but this is one small step to deal with that. In terms of Representative Brown's question about, you know, could the municipal league do it with the resources that we have available right now, no, we could not do this ourselves. It's obviously a process that's going to cost some money to have somebody coordinate and bring together. And yes, you get some information from some of our folks. Unfortunately, a lot of that is just don't do this to us. And we have tried to and wish we had the capacity to provide more hard data as to what that is. And I think this would be a good step toward that. You know, we can't... You can't make decisions on just a, no, don't do this to us. You need to know how much that fiscal impact is going to be and what that's going to do to the municipal budget. So I think this is a good step toward that. We also, given the fact that we support it, would like it to be done right. And that's, we would certainly support the department in their request for a larger fiscal note. I haven't really had a chance to think about, you know, what would happen on the Finance Committee question that you raised, but I think Representative McLean's point about not everything ends up here is a good, so unless you had every bill in.